Hello, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. I'm joined this afternoon by my friend and yours, my usual producer, but today guest, Anya Esther, a convert to Judaism, someone who's read and studied a lot about Judaism and Jewish history, has even taught some young people, done some teaching as well. So yeah. I thought, what better person to join us today to help facilitate this discussion on Holocaust Remembrance Day? That music, if familiar to you, is part of the soundtrack of Schindler's List. I have probably played that piece, you know, because that's, for those that listen, know I'm a violinist.
Yes.
A number of times. It remains one of the most beautiful, I think, movie scores out there. Painful to play.
Oh, I bet.
But extremely beautiful and moving. It's one of those pieces that when I play, it's oftentimes very hard to like keep it together while you're playing.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, at least I don't play a woodwind instrument. You know, that's actually impossible. You can cry and play the violin at the same time. That actually works.
It's made for that a little bit in that way. But crying
while
fluting. You
want to get the tears off the violin wood because you'll strip your varnish.
Yeah.
But you can at least play and cry at the same time. We're talking today, last hour, we talked a little bit about some of the basic facts surrounding the Holocaust, but I also wanted to ask you, what are some things about the Holocaust that people maybe haven't known or heard about?
Yeah, of course. The Holocaust is such a huge topic. I think it is so important to remind folks that there's a reason that this conflict was called the Second World War. I think too often it gets brought down to, it's just America and Germany and the UK and Japan. Is like, when you sort of zoom out, you understand, no, really, truly, the whole Northern Hemisphere and a little bit below that was involved. And so I just picked a couple sort of points throughout this topic to touch on. I wanted to first discuss a group that just far too often is not known about or completely forgotten about, and that is the Greek Jewish community. Greek Jews before the Holocaust, obviously a minority in Greece, but Jews in Greece, that dates back to the biblical period. This is a long established relationship between the Jewish world and the Greek world. During the Holocaust, however, Greek Jews were they had more obstacles in front of them, because where Central European and Northern Jews often had shared languages, if not Hebrew and Yiddish, then something like, well, if I speak German and you speak Dutch, we can get by pretty well. However, there's a reason people say it's Greek to me. Greek does not share cognates, does not share a lot of similarities with these other languages. And a lot of the Greek Jewish community was not speaking Yiddish and Hebrew as much as they were Greek, which meant that when Greek Jews were put into ghettos or put into camps and given instructions by officers or, you know, enlisted for the slave labor portion of life in these camps, because they couldn't understand, many Nazi officers would simply kill them where they stood as an act of, you know, brutal violence in front of other prisoners. So it's believed that Greece's Jewish population was reduced by 94%. One particular town here, Salonika had about 43,000 Greek Jews who were taken to camps, and only 3,000 of those Jews survived. So this is a community that was truly decimated. There were very few Greek survivors in the first place at the time of liberations of camps. So, of course, nowadays, when we talk about how many survivors have passed away of old age and such, mm-hmm. we don't have people around so much to speak for these communities. So I wanted to speak up for them, because this is one of the communities that was the most devastated, that was taken the closest to complete annihilation. Truly, roughly 6% of their community made it through. And that's really unimaginable.
It truly is. When you couple both the geographic isolation of Greece, right, in a way, as well as the language isolation. And we see that repeated throughout human history,
yes,
that factors of isolation, whether by virtue of the accident of geography or the accident of culture and language, make certain groups much more vulnerable to, frankly, these kinds of targeted pogroms, if you will.
Very much so.
And it's one of the things that I fear, again, we aren't to fascism. We aren't to that full expression of hate, but we have rumblings of it here.
Right. Yes.
And, you know, when we look at the rates of suicide for transgender youth, yep, and that is the most at-risk group, the reason why is that the group, those people can easily become isolated from their families, from community, especially with some of the rhetoric that's gotten ramped up and amped up over the last, say, I don't know, since round about 2015-ish.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's putting people at physical, at incredible peril.
Yes.
Physically as well as mentally. And so, again, I think we need to understand, as you put it, the rhyming of history.
Yes.
Across decades and centuries. I know you also wanted to talk about, and I had never heard about this, the Shanghai Ghetto.
Yeah, so this topic is very fascinating to me. I was prepping a Holocaust lecture for a theater performing cabaret, and I just, for some reason, I wanted a list of all the ghettos that existed during the Holocaust, and at the very bottom, it listed the Shanghai Ghetto. I had to fact check it. Yes, so there were, at the time of the Holocaust in the early 40s, there were about 23,000 Jewish folks living in the city of Shanghai. China had early on in the war been seen as a potential refuge for Jewish people, that maybe tensions were less, maybe between what Chinese culture and Jewish culture was like. They'd just be a couple of strangers in a strange land, not so much like in Europe, where it's like, well, you're almost too close to us. Let's push everything away. So as the Japanese encroached on China, of course, Japanese being part of the Axis powers with the Nazis, the Japanese army forced those 23,000 residents into this, one square mile inside the Hongku district of the Japanese occupied Shanghai. It's just a very shocking thing to realize. You imagine the Warsaw and the Krakow ghettos, you can see occupied Paris. But the idea that there was a one square block or one mile block in China also exacting the will of the Nazis, attempting to pull Jewish people who had tried to flee, who had tried to make a different life for themselves. Even they, the power of the Nazis, were able to reach out so far away. And that's why I talk about the world element. People don't realize the Nazis had operations in North Africa.
Right.
They don't realize this was happening in China. Many folks don't realize how many Nazis and Nazi sympathizers fled to South America,
yeah,
afterwards, and that the influence reaches there as well. It is truly a world conflict, something that affected all of us in ways we might not even fully understand.
We're going to talk about some of the more recent manifestations, representations of the Holocaust, especially in film.
Yes.
There's just been a lot of celluloid, if you will,
oh, yes,
used to represent the Holocaust and World War II in film. And I think, again, like all things, some films more successful than others. Some films trade in I think, some tropes and stereotypes,
right,
that are not very helpful. After the war, were all, what happened to the Jews that were in this Shanghai ghetto?
That's an excellent question. A big part of it was the fleeing of Japanese forces that allowed the ghetto to reopen. It was really only after, let me see here, yes, September 3rd of 1945, that this ghetto was officially liberated. And it was simply because with the war coming to an end, as the Nazis were prioritizing, trying to hold out whatever they had left in Central Europe, the Pacific theater and the war happening in Asia became less and less important to them. I should also mention that the some of the men who worked to make life in that ghetto easier were awarded the same award that Oskar Schindler would later get, Righteous Among the Nations. So truly, we can find similar stories that we were seeing in Central Europe throughout Asia as well.
And it's interesting, you know, when we start to talk about the representations of the Holocaust and also some of the modern elements of that. I mean, we still see, I think there was a Netflix series about basically like Nazi hunters in South America.
Yes.
And many people are familiar, with Adolf Eichmann. Listen, folks, if you think the Holocaust was some recent memory, or long ago memory, there are very recent events that there are still unaccounted for Nazi leaders. Yes. Some people still believe that many of them may be living in South America.
Yes.
One of the things that continues to this day, it comes up at least once or twice a year with the most famous museums in this country, is the theft of and return of art to Jewish families.
Yes.
Sitting in every major museum in this country right now is likely a piece of art that was taken by Nazis from a Jewish family.
Yes.
And many people, I think, are quite surprised to know that provenance, right, the tracking of the history of a piece of art, if you will, the art's pedigree.
Yes.
Who it went from person to person. Often museums will argue about provenance, will argue about where a piece of art came from in order to maintain possession of disputed art. That remains a big current issue. My guest this afternoon, typically my producer, but today my special guest and friend, Anya Esther. We're having an observation here on the Maggie Dawn Show of Holocaust Remembrance Day. You can join us. We're going to go to the phones and take some texts and messages from Facebook, X, and what's the other one? Facebook, X. Oh, and YouTube we're on when we come back. Stay put, everybody. We'll be back in just a moment. Wisconsin. It is Holocaust Remembrance Day, so we're having a special episode of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Network. And I'm joined today to help us walk through this remembrance, my producer, but today my guest and always my friend, Anya Esther. Thanks so much for helping us this afternoon, Anya. I really appreciate it. We were talking just before our last break about things about the Holocaust that you may not have heard about. And I know that you wanted to talk a little bit about the Kindertransport.
Yeah. So outside of these other two topics, I think more people are familiar with the Kindertransport, but it's just such an important piece. So this was the effort made mostly by folks based in the UK, but also throughout other parts of unoccupied Europe, to attempt to get the children of Jewish families out, placing them oftentimes with Catholic families or Catholic orphanages, attempting to give them the knowledge and such to pass essentially as non-Jewish children. It was a heroic attempt. It was an important attempt. But I think so often the various attempts to save groups of children we discuss in Holocaust studies, folks like Oskar Schindler, who did both for adults and children, many, many Catholic priests throughout Poland and so on. But it is important to understand that the best efforts were still very, very small. 10,000 children ended up surviving the Holocaust or being transported out of occupied Europe on the Kindertransport. The vast majority of these children were orphans. They may not have ever found or known how or when their parents passed, but they ended up being orphans. It is important to note that 10,000 children were saved. It's estimated that roughly 1.5 million of the Holocaust victims were children. And that number is lower than reality, because we do know through our studies that so many pregnancies, so many young newborns, so many young children were murdered, killed, lost, and never documented. So to understand the Kinder transport, very important, very huge, 10,000 lives saved. And also what a drop in the bucket it is compared to the totality, the brutality of the Nazi regime. It's sort of a tanker just taking over a toy car. It's a huge, huge difference, and important nonetheless.
Well, I think one of the one notable fact is the British government's willingness to accept the children. These were the word for these kids is refugees.
Yes, yes,
migrants, if you will. Oh my goodness! Imagine that. And it highlights again to me the challenges that we have in these moments, not to dehumanize, that when you dehumanize migrants, right, or refugees, as the former MAGA president does all of the time, or to say they're all bad people, that is simple. We all know that that's not true.
Right.
We all know that. We all understand that our ability to care for folks in a humane way isn't where it needs to be, and
right,
that we're having problems because of that. But to, again, refer to people as vermin, to deny the humanity of people fleeing their countries,
right,
is really it's again, this rhetoric that we're seeing now, I think, is incredibly disturbing. And, you know, what is our moral responsibility?
Exactly.
Whether we're, you know, living in Milwaukee or up north, again, what is our moral responsibility as a state and communities and as a nation? And are we really living up to our highest ideals?
Right. I mean, I think one easy, if you can call it that, answer of what are we, what can we do? Are we, you know, as you said at the top of this hour, it's about bearing witness. I was in a fellowship called We Bear Witness. That was about going over to Europe and seeing the sites. But having these conversations and simply continuing your learning, you know, it's only through researching these things that I find instances in history where I go, oh, the beer hall putsch, that's very interesting. Group of people got together and went into a building they weren't meant to be in and caused havoc and tried to overthrow the government. Well, where have I heard that before? Very interesting. It's only through doing that deeper research, the day by day, the things that are now sort of mundane and boring compared to the total brutality of the murders that come, one has to study the preamble to it. And in there, that is where we're finding so many of these things that are just too similar. And to talk about acceptance, too, it's important to understand there were meetings among European nations in the lead up to the Holocaust where those nations said affirmatively, we will not take Jews. Those same nations, a couple years later, would dab their eyes and say, my God, what a tragedy. We must punish Germany for this. But they did have the opportunity to do something. We have the opportunity to do something for the totality of things happening in our world. We are not powerless. Even just through learning, we are not powerless.
Yeah, I think I call it the humility of openness.
Yes.
That I don't know everything and that I can always learn from someone. And mm-hmm. the biggest amount of learning comes from people that are often the least like you, right? That's mm-hmm. that's the humility of openness, to try to understand more, to try to do better. Mark from Prairie du Sac, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was interested to hear Anya mentioned the Hellenized Jews that were actually in Greece. I mean, that it's interesting. I just read something, I think it was in Thomas Cahill's book, The Desire of the Everlasting Hills. He was talking about Rome and early Christianity, but apparently he mentioned that there's a rabbi that's actually depositing that Christianity is simply another school of Jewish thought, that because Jesus, of course, was a Jew and a rabbi, that, you know, we're following, you know, the rabbi Jesus in Christianity. That, and for the Holocaust, I can remember first hearing about that, that I remember in fifth grade when my teacher, Mrs. Mackey, was talking, addressing the class about the Holocaust and the showers and all that. And further on, then Mrs. Trepan, you're in sixth grade, you know, talking about the horrors of the camps. That, and then we hear that, you know, PBS has run their thing, I think it's going to run again, that on the U.S. and the Holocaust, we could have accepted so many Jews in this country, as well the rest of the world could have opened up. But, I mean, the anti-Semitism that was rife in this country, I mean, Henry Ford, you know, wrote a paper called The International Jew, that just feeling the anti-Semitism, and that it just is rich to me that some of these people, these very same people that, you know, they're all in support of Israel, but the anti-Semitism that kind of runs through some of their stuff, just kind of how you hold those two thoughts in your brain at the same time is just shocking to me because...
Yes. That's it, yep. Mark, isn't it? Let's not forget who was in Charlottesville, Virginia at the Unite the Right rally. It seems to me that Mark's got his finger on exactly some of the tension that especially some of the groups supporting the former MAGA president and on the far right, it just simply, you can't bring these things into alignment. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, folks on Facebook, Instagram. Okay, Facebook, X, and YouTube. I can never remember it. Everybody's welcome to text in. To call, we'll take a few more of your texts and comments when we come back. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Stay put. Your farm update is next. Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. I'm joined by my producer today, guest and friend every day, but today guest, Anya Esther. We are observing Holocaust Remembrance Day. If you missed the beginning of the show, not to worry. You can go check that out at civicmedia.us. All the past episodes are podcasted. You can go grab our app for free from anywhere, and that will take you to our website as well, where you can check out past episodes. Thanks again, Anya, for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Yes, I appreciate having the time to come talk about this because it's very, very big and important topic.
Yes, and I think, you know, given all of the controversy, one could say is probably a mild term, but the protests that are occurring on campuses and the discussions that are ongoing about Prime Minister Netanyahu's response to the October 7th terrorist attack and the 100 plus hostages of Israel that remain with Hamas. It's important to understand some of this history. I wanted to spend our next bit of time talking about the representations of the Holocaust in media, specifically what I'm going to call the entertainment industry, for lack of in film. and we were talking a bit, I know we had mentioned Adolf Eichmann, one of the terms or phrases attributed to Eichmann is the banality of evil, because he was very much sort of a bean counter type, and his demeanor was shocking to many when he discussed his role in a genocide.
Yes.
And I think some of that is really important to remember. It's part and parcel of this discussion that we've been having about these steps towards fascism, these steps that led to a genocide began with rhetoric of exclusion, hate, and dehumanization of groups of people. And that a society's willingness to accept that is the necessary factual predicate for a society's accepting the banality of evil. And there's a film that came out, I think, 2023, late 23, or was it early 24?
Zone of Interest?
Yes.
Yes, late 23.
Late 23, that's garnered a lot of attention. And I think really the very purpose of the film is to highlight and to show that evil can show up as very banal. I wanted to get your impressions about the Zone of Interest. We're going to talk about better representations and discussions, engagements with the complexities and the brutality, the horror, the evil of the Holocaust, and films that don't do a good job, because I think that's just as important for people to understand. But I thought we could start with some of the sound from the film Zone of Interest. I've seen it.
Yes.
You've seen it.
Yep.
This, to me, the soundtrack is the film.
Yes.
And so let's take a listen. We'll leave it there. Describe to folks what you hear there, Anya.
It's the whole film. You teed it up perfectly. The banality of evil. The sound you hear in this is so simple and so sort of boring. You want to tune it out. It's shuffling. It's this. It's that. But there's this hum. There's this rumble. There's this low groan that continues through the film. And there's the sounds of human voices, of the screaming potentially, like deep down in that sound design. But that low hum is sound wise in reference to the sound, the kinetic sound of the gas, or not the crematories, the constant burning of bodies, because that is how many people were being killed in this place. I think if this film does anything very, very well, and it does a number of things very well, but to have this constant hum, to understand that for the decade or so that the Nazi regime existed, this hum of murder, this hum of destruction was the undertone of all that the Nazis did. And to also understand that these families who moved to work at these camps, like Hoss and his family, you know, this hum was something they were constantly trying to stifle, the smell and all of this. To not be reminded of what they were participating in, essentially, you know, bore the masses and bore yourself until the people you want to destroy are gone. Then we can all get really active and engaged again. So I think that sound, what sounds truly like nothing, is actually the sound of
genocide.
So much. It's the sound of genocide. It's the sound of the story that's not being shown in the pictures in this film. What's happening just on the other side of the manicured shrubs and the picnics and whatnot.
Yeah, so the... thank you.
Yeah.
It's difficult to even listen to. I found many moments in the film where you're watching the banality of the day-to-day life of a family. You're never shown the inside of Auschwitz.
Right.
That was an intentional choice.
Yes.
By the producer, by the director, I should say. Mm-hmm. You're watching just... and the way that the inside of the house was shot was just, there was a lot of set cameras and you would just see people moving through the house.
Yes.
And again, the day-to-day stuff of moving laundry around. And then you figure out, oh, this isn't a pile of laundry. The woman of the house is rifling through clothing taken from Jewish people to decide which of it she wants. And then that which is left over, she gives to other people in the home. And so you're watching that. And in the back is this constant sound of the ovens, of the crematorium, of the dogs barking. Often you'll hear shouts, or it sounds like commands being given by presumptively troops at the camp.
Right.
And you will hear humans crying out. You will hear gunshots.
Yes.
And all of that's happening while you're watching a mom take her kids for a little stroll in their beautifully manicured garden.
Yeah.
While they have picnics, one of the most challenging scenes in the, there are many, that breaks through what I'm going to call the fourth wall of their own ignorance. They create this, they just force themselves to ignore what's happening literally in their backyard. This is the story based on some truth, but the film based on a 2014 novel. But it's the story of a family and the commandant of Auschwitz.
Yeah.
Who...
Commandant Haus.
Haus.
Is, yes. No, he's not referenced in Schindler's List. But yeah, Haus, real historical
figure. Real person.
Figure.
Yes, this is a real person. His family lived right next to Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene I'm referring to is he has taken his children to have a swim in the river that's nearby. And... they're carousing around. He's fishing, and he realizes that there's so much ash in the river itself from a genocide that they're likely sort of breathing it in, and it's getting on his kids, and he takes them out of the river. And that's where the truth of what's happening sort of breaks through.
Right.
Where do you place Zone of Interest in terms of films trying to represent, I don't know any film that can fully represent or give people an actual insight into something like that.
Yeah.
But presents it in a way that challenges people to think about it, perhaps in a different way, in a new way.
I would rank it, to avoid ranking it, I would say I would place it in the group of Holocaust films that I think are good and that are useful. I tend to recommend against films that center the perpetrator's point of view, especially a fictitious point of view. Films like Boy in the Striped Pajamas, Jojo Rabbit, major sections of Inglourious Basterds. But this film, rather, while it is from the perpetrator's point of view, it is not one of attempting to force empathy or one attempting. It's rather, no, allow us to really show you almost, it's not a documentary, but almost in a more documentary
sort of style.
Yes. Let us show you without making you like them, without making them the protagonist. I place it in the group of films that I think people should watch to have a better understanding of what the perpetrator's side was, the constant attempts to ignore it. I take some issue, like I said, with coming at it from the perpetrator's point of view. I take some issue with parts of how it's represented, but I think overall it's a very, very strong film, a very important film on that side of the story.
I think part of the complexity, if you're ever showing, you know, the perpetrator's perspective,
yeah,
is that it can humanize.
Yes.
And yet, understanding that these were people that 10 years before, had you told them what they would be participating in, my guess is that they would deny it.
Yes. Right.
And so how do you go from, I'm no racist, I'm not a murderer, to being the commandant of Auschwitz in 10 years?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In other words, understanding that there is a part of human psychology that I would never do that. But some people did do that.
Yes.
There's something in human psychology that can allow people to get to that place.
Yes. And there was something about the depravity against the Jewish people in the Holocaust. It's important to understand so many people who were Nazis had also been World War I veterans, deeply traumatized people who had seen really awful things, who unfortunately were given the opportunity to exact needless pain and suffering upon people. I use the term spite a lot. I use the term retribution. So it's important to understand the banality of it. At the 20,000-foot view, you zoom in and find copious, copious brutality like what you're describing.
Well, and not to put too fine a point on it, the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Yes.
Has shown us that human beings, when put into positions of complete authority,
yes,
and told over and over and again that the people that they are imprisoning, guarding, what have you, inhuman and not worth anything, that human beings will start to become grotesquely abusive towards one another.
Yes.
That what the rhetoric, the way that we talk about people is incredibly important.
Yes.
Again, if you're not familiar with the Stanford Prison Experiment, it occurred at Stanford in August of 1971. It was supposed to be a 2-week simulation of a prison environment. Needless to say, they had students that volunteered. Some students were the prisoners. Some students were the guards. And eventually, the guards became so abusive towards the student mock prisoners that they had to stop the experiment. It's pretty shocking. There's video from it. And we know this from even a Bugarub, right? That this can happen. And so, again, heard as to that tension of, are you humanizing perpetrators? Yes. But the humanization, the understanding, like, wait a minute.
That there's still
how much
limit.
Rhetoric are we accepting in our current political discourse?
Yes.
That, again, is predicate to this sort of depravity, this sort of dehumanization.
How much of the unforgivable can we forgive? The hope is you don't forgive what's unforgivable. You witness it, you discuss it, but in this time and age, yes, it's hard to talk about the perpetrator side and not write something or watch someone write something that is too humanizing in
yes.
that way.
Heard. Hi, Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. We'll take your phone calls and texts after these brief messages. 855-75-CIVIC. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Network. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and so I've been joined this afternoon by my colleague and friend, Anya Esther, who converted to Judaism as an adult and has spent a long time studying and also teaching and sharing with people history related to the Holocaust. We've been talking for the last bit of the segments about the representation of the Holocaust in particular in film, a new film that came out, Zone of Interest. Its director made some remarks after winning an award that created quite a controversy. If you want, and you don't have to, we can share exactly what was said, or we can just talk about what was problematic.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell people exactly what he said first?
Yeah, well, so Jonathan Glazer, director of the film, accepting an Oscar, made this speech. Essentially, the most important part of it is towards the end, he in reference to what is happening in Gaza and in Israel, said, we are men refuting our Judaism. And this approach... I found to be so deeply wrong on Glazer's part. He made a statement that was needless. Refuting your Judaism, any of us refuting any religion, does nothing to change what is happening in the Middle East, because it has nothing to do. It is not inherently tied to your religious identity. This is a conflict that has gone on for many years. It is somehow much bigger than just religion.
Right.
So his choice to use those words, I think, endangered and put many other Jews in a deeply wrong place, where people are asking, you know, are you going to refute your Judaism, you know, and be a good person like Jonathan Glazer was, to atone for what's happening over there? And it's just a whole can of worms where you go, That's not what you think it is. Like, even doing that wouldn't help, you know?
And I don't think I can atone
right
for whatever wrongs are occurring.
Yeah.
Whatever dehumanization is occurring, by saying I give up, I won't identify with my religious tradition.
Right.
The objective here is to get to a place where human dignity is respected and we have a system of laws and rules of armed conflict that actually ensure that is the case for non-combatants. That is the challenge. The full sentence, right now we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. He was tying the refutation of Jewishness as it being hijacked. But again, syntactically, the way that he expressed that was really, I think, flawed.
Yes.
That's not a good way to say what he was, I think, maybe trying to say.
And for him to say, too, the Holocaust being hijacked, I fear he could say the same thing about me saying history repeats.
Yeah.
You know, the Holocaust is a historical event that occurred. We can look at the facts. I don't think he's inherently wrong in saying he sees places where it rhymes in that conflict. I do as well. But the way he went about it was sort of like saying, well, I'm upset with the last election. I'm refuting being an American. It's like, well, that doesn't really help us solve anything, does it? Nor does it help anyone to just refute.
That is it right there. Clip it and run it. That does not help us solve anything. Let's go to the phone. CJ. CJ from Stoughton, you're on.
Thank you, Maggie and Anna, for taking my call. I want to commend you for recognizing today, because the ignorance that's being portrayed at our universities today by not just the students and some that got caught up in people who shouldn't be at these schools, you see it in the faculty, you see it in their administrations. It's disgusting. And what the Jewish people have been put through, the students, and the lack of knowledge, because you can still be wishful for Palestinians and Gaza, but you cannot support Hamas.
Couldn't agree with you more, CJ. Thanks very much for your call and for listening. I appreciate it.
And that is the distinction between supporting liberation, supporting Hamas. When it comes to talking about the Holocaust, it's the same as, look, you don't just support the enemy of your enemy. Probably isn't actually your friend.
Yeah.
The enemy of your enemy is probably also someone you should check out and ensure how you feel about them, not based on your enemy. So with all these things of Hamas and all these things, just trying to be better about it.
Yes.
Be better about knowing what we're saying. Yes.
A terrorist group.
Yes.
Is not representative of all Palestinians.
Of course.
Jack from Merrimack, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show.
Thank you. I have just an observation. According to what I've read, the Nazi Party in Germany was never supported actively by more than about a third of the German people. And the other two-thirds of the people in Germany basically said, well, it's not going to be that bad, or this is not going to affect me anyway, so why bother? I'm going to take that to today, the current MAGA party. There's about a third of the people in this country support it, and there's an awful lot of people out there that, I know about Project 2025, but it's not going to get that bad.
I think that is the question that you're pointing to, Jack. The last elections were in November of 1932. And in November of 1932, the Nazi Party basically had 33% of the vote.
Yep.
And they had lost a bit of support from their prior election. But again, by March 1933, the Nazi Party had just under 44%, but then how do you who was really voting? It gets murky, but your point is that, evil succeeds, injustice prevails when good people allow it to, when they remain silent in the face of hate and otherization and dehumanizing. Whether that's coming from the right or the far left, it is not a good thing.
Yep.
Thanks, Anya, so much for doing this with
me today. Thank you, Maggie. Thank you.
We'll have more for you all on Wednesday if we've got time. Now, we've got President Biden coming to Racine. If we don't get to it on Wednesday, we're going to talk a little bit about Holocaust denialism and about how do we actually prevent genocide. What is our role?
Yes.
I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. Thanks so much for listening. I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But remember, it is better when we stand together.
running, cause the winner.